Before we jump in this morning, I wanted to say a sincere thank you. Last week, our semester of Sunday school ended, and I want to thank all of our teachers and all of our helpers. We have some of the most dedicated teachers and helpers ministering in our children's ministry. And sincerely, I cannot thank you enough for coming alongside of us as parents, for making it to where we're not raising our kids alone in the faith, and we thank you. And evidently, your teaching is so good that my son Asher has developed the confidence to challenge his dad on what he knows. Lately been challenging, wanting to take that heavyweight belt in our home from his old man. I was driving a couple weeks ago with Asher and Ava. Asher's 8, and Ava just turned 5. It's just the three of us in the car. And I made some comment where I said, well, Jesus goes by many different names around the world. I said, in Hebrew, he goes by Yeshua. In Greek, he goes by Jesus. And Asher from the back, he goes, oh, yeah? Well, what do they call him in China? I said, Yesu. He goes, oh, yeah, well, what do they call him in India? Yesu. Oh, yeah, well, what do they call him in Mexico? Jesus. And poor little Ava, she was back there. She's got to do everything that her big bubba does, and I could just see that little mind working, just trying to think of a place in her little world, and she finally saw an opening. She thought of a place, and she said, oh, yeah? What do they call him at Grandma's house? I said, Ava, I don't know. Grandma lives in a dark and pagan land. And then a couple of nights later, I was with Asher. We were getting ready to read the Bible story that night, and we were actually reviewing, and we reviewed the Lord's Supper and the crucifixion. And he asked, just out of nowhere, he goes, what happens when we die? And I said, well, your body will turn to dust in the grave, and your soul is going to go and be with Jesus because it belongs to him, and he doesn't lose anything that belongs to him. He goes, yeah, I know. I was like, what is this, oral exams for ordination? I was like, Father, you have done well. And I said, well, after that, you know what else is going to happen? I said, one of these days, Jesus is going to come back. And when he does, all of those bodies that turn to dust in the grave, he's going to resurrect them. And millions upon millions of bodies are going to come out of the earth. They're going to come out of the sea. And he's going to resurrect them all at once. And they're going to meet him in the sky. And he looked at me and he goes, whoa, when is that going to happen? So friends, if today tells you anything, do you have any idea who's coming for you? May your heart say whoa this morning. Thomas is the disciple that we're not supposed to be. At least that's how he's always presented to us. Thomas is the negative example. He's the disciple who occupies such a low place in our minds. Because when we consider the disciples, there's Judas at the bottom for obvious reasons. But then just one rung above him is Thomas. Like he got in, but just barely. So the lesson goes like this, does it not? Boys and girls, don't be like Thomas, because Thomas is a doubter. And if you doubt, then Jesus is going to magically appear in the room and shame you in front of all of your friends. So don't be a doubter like Thomas. So then Thomas represents everything that we are not supposed to be, so much so that we rename him to Doubting Thomas as a perpetual warning against the almost unforgivable sin of doubt. Because real faith, we've been told, doesn't doubt. And so, of course, Jesus shows up to rebuke Thomas for his lack of faith. And he'll do the same to you. The truth is, I don't buy any of that. The way this story gets read through a lens that just presents a faith that doesn't have any room for doubt and struggle. Maybe that's the faith you were raised with. Maybe that's the faith that you were presented with and the only faith that you've ever known. And sure, maybe Jesus himself didn't show up to shame you, but somebody else did. Whenever you had doubt and you struggled to believe. But if there's no room for doubt and struggle in this faith, then there's no room for Moses at the burning bush. You have to remove Elijah from the mountaintop. You have to cut David from the Psalms. You have to pull Jeremiah out of the cistern. And when you do, all you are really left with is a book of laws. And if there's no room for them, then there's no room for any of us. Because we all have doubt. But the saddest part of all of that, if you were presented with that kind of faith, is that you were just taught to avoid all of the places where God actually would meet you. We all have doubt. We are all Thomas. There's a picture hanging on my wall in the office of an old woman in the deep forest of India. I met her in 2014. Our team had just dedicated a church that we'd built for one of the pastors named Eliah. And afterwards, Eliah was walking us through the small village, telling us the story of his ministry there. And we came upon this woman sitting outside of her house. And Eliah stopped and talked with her for a bit. And we obviously didn't know what they were saying. And so we asked later who she was. And Eliah told us that he had preached in that village for 6 years before he had his first convert. 6 years. For 6 years, whenever he would come to preach, the men of that village would chase him and beat him with sticks. And sometimes they tried to kill him. And he said on many occasions when he would run, that woman would hide him in her house until he could escape at night. And standing there on that dirt road, you realize we are just so averse to any form of suffering. And here Pastor Elijah's life was devoted to it, with the scars on his face to prove it. And even as Christians, we think, man, what would make him do that? What would give him the courage and the resolve to enter into that kind of darkness over and over and over again? It's crazy to us. But actually, the craziest part of Elijah's story is how he entered into ministry in the first place. At one time, Elijah was a devout Hindu. And there was a pastor that would come and preach in his village, and Elijah hated every single word of it. He would join in with the other men of the village, and they would beat this pastor with sticks, and they would run him off. And then one day, Elijah's son, his little boy, got sick. And he prayed, and he prayed, and he prayed to his gods, but his little boy died. Devastation beyond devastation. But Elijah remembered that pastor. He remembered something he said. So he went to all of the surrounding villages frantically trying to find him. And when he found him, Elijah said, "You say your God can raise the dead." Pastor said, "Yes, he can." Then Elias said, "Then you will come and pray for my son, and if he is raised from the dead, then I will give my life to your God. But if he isn't raised from the dead, I'm going to kill you." Crazy enough, the pastor went with him. He and Elijah run back to his village. They enter the hut. The pastor kneels down. He prays. And Elijah watched as his little boy was raised from the dead. But here's the thing. Do you believe it? Or do you feel that doubt rising up within you right now? You're looking for a way out. Something to explain it away. Maybe it was just a weak pulse. Maybe he was just comatose. Eli, after all, is really poor. Perhaps he's just prone to superstition. Doubt comes to us all much easier than we'd like to admit, doesn't it? We are all Thomas. But do you know the one thing that you cannot doubt? Do you know the one thing that is absolutely beyond question? Elijah's scars. It's those scars on his body and his face. Those scars call your doubt to question. Those scars tell you that something happened. Something that would cause Elijah to so willingly endure such suffering and pain. It's those scars that tell you maybe life really did come from death. In this faith, do you know what doubt really is? Doubt is that space where life is infiltrating upon death. It's where light begins to shine in the darkness. And it starts to challenge what you think is possible, what you think is true, and the way that you think the world works. It's where you're challenged to let go of that despair that makes you feel safe. It's where you want to believe, yet you struggle to believe at the same time because it goes against everything that you've ever known and it dares you to hope. Doubt is inevitable. Why? Because light is breaking into this world. Life is overcoming death. So maybe that should change how we approach this story of Thomas. Because interpreting this story as though Jesus is just rebuking a weak, faithless Thomas and shaming him completely misses the point of the entire story. It also completely misunderstands who Thomas actually was. In John 11, when Lazarus died and Jesus heard the news, he actually waited where he was for multiple days. And then finally, he told the disciples it was time to go back to Judea where Lazarus was buried. And all of the disciples said no, because that would actually just take him back to a place that had just tried to stone him. But it was Thomas who said no. Let us go with him, that at least we might die with him. Does that sound like a man of weak faith? And what happened to Thomas after the Great Commission? Thomas went to India. He went further to the ends of the earth than any other disciple went. And to get there meant that he had to be one of the first ones to leave too. Because he traveled 5,000 miles on foot from Jerusalem to Chennai. And do you know where he went? He went to a Kaligat. He entered into the belly of the beast, where we ourselves have gone, to worshipers of Kali, a goddess of destruction, deep in the heart of darkness, deep in a Kali-got brothel system. So many of you have seen and felt that darkness. And his ministry was so successful that he was killed by the priests of Kali, because so many were converted by him. Does this sound like a man of weak faith? So maybe there's more to Thomas than this caricature that we've been presented. So then maybe there's more to this moment than we understand. John is not telling us about Thomas as a warning for those who doubt. No, he's giving us Thomas as an example for when we do. He's not some warning tagged on at the end of the story. Thomas is actually the climax of the entire book. And if you step back and you look at the broader story in this passage, Jesus appeared to the other 10 disciples on the evening of the first Easter. But then he didn't appear to Thomas until 8 days later. And when he does, it's easy to just think that Jesus appeared to Thomas just to blow him up and tie up some loose ends. But no, Jesus is not petty. He knew exactly what he was doing. So why did he wait 8 days? Because for one, Jesus had to appear to Thomas. It's not like he's just showing up in this passage just to one-up him. Jesus had to appear to Thomas. In order for him to go from being one of the 12 disciples to being one of the 12 apostles, he had to see the resurrected Christ bodily. But Jesus also had to appear to Thomas because he promised him that he would. We heard it in recent weeks in the upper room. Jesus made so many promises, and the most of which when he said, "I'm leaving you and you will see me no longer, and you will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn to joy because I will come back to you." So when Jesus appeared to the 10 disciples that night of the first Easter, he knew Thomas was not there. He did not appear in the room and say, "Guys, it's me. I'm back. Wait, where's Thomas at? I thought all of you were here." No, he knew Thomas wasn't there. So then if he had to appear to Thomas, then why did he wait? Why did Jesus wait 8 days to appear to Thomas? And really, why does Jesus wait to come to you? The only other time in the Gospel of John where Jesus intentionally waited before going to the ones that he loved was to Mary and Martha after Lazarus, their brother, died. Jesus intentionally skipped the funeral. He waited multiple days. He waited until that stone was rolled over that grave. He waited until all hope was gone. He waited until after the funeral, when life went back to normal for everybody else, and he knew that he would find Mary and Martha at the bottom of that ocean of grief. So why did Jesus wait then to go to Thomas? Because he knows Thomas is grieving. That's why Thomas wasn't there that Easter night. He was grieving. Probably just wanted to be alone, to get away, to not be around those who just be a reminder of everything he'd lost. Sometimes you are inconsolable even for the ones that you love. Maybe the last 3 years was the first time he'd ever felt a part of something. Maybe he'd already lost so many people in his life. Maybe he finally experienced real community and he finally felt like he belonged somewhere. Maybe the last 3 years finally gave his life a sense of meaning and significance. But that crucifixion threw all of those hopes in the grave, and all that he had left was grief. So just like with Mary and Martha, Jesus is waiting until Thomas sinks to the utter depths of grief. And grief is where doubt begins to grow. Doubt grows in the soil of grief, where hope feels so pointless and empty. And maybe up to this point, you've been sitting there thinking, you know, I don't really struggle with doubt. No, you were thinking about doubt way too rationally. Maybe the truth is you've actually just learned to live so closely with it that you don't even recognize it anymore. Isn't it in grief that your doubts begin to rise to the surface? In the grief of a struggling marriage, you doubt anything will ever change. In the grief of career disappointments or just wishing that you would have made different decisions in life, you doubt that you'll ever know the meaning and significance that you desire. In the grief of ongoing addiction, you doubt you'll ever know a real day of freedom, and you will always be this way. The grief of watching your kids make their decisions or the same mistakes, and you doubt that light will ever break through. Or maybe you know exactly why Thomas didn't show up that night. It's for the same reason it's hard for you to engage in community. Because those past hurts make you doubt that you could ever really be known and not be hurt. So why show up? For the same reason why it's hard to commit to going to church, because the grief of past experience makes you doubt it's even worth it. So why show up? Or why it's hard to pray when so many of your prayers have gone unanswered and all you'll get is the great silence of God. So why show up? It's in the grief of this world that our doubts rise up within us, that we are all alone and no one is coming for us. Doubt is that place where we struggle to believe that things could change, that life could be different, that joy could overcome sorrow, that light could shine in darkness, that good can triumph over evil, and you feel stuck in dark Saturday. Where that doubt convinces you to live like your God is still in the grave and the world won. So Jesus waits. He waits until Thomas sinks to the bottom of all of that grief. But he also waits because grief is where something else happens. It's where faith takes on its finest form. There is a hope that can only be found in the utter depths of grief. There's a hope and a longing that can only be found in the broken heart of man, because it's where we finally lift our hands. And the disciples find Thomas in all of his grief, and they say, "We have seen the Lord." We've seen him. Thomas, we've seen him. And what does Thomas say? I love his response. "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and I put my finger in the mark of those nails, and unless I place my hand in his side, I will never believe. Unless I touch those scars, I will never believe." And that response just gets treated as though Thomas is just a modern skeptic. Like all of a sudden in this passage, he's just a modern atheist that's demanding empirical evidence to rationally deduce that Jesus rose from the dead. Why? Because the church doesn't know what to do with those who grieve. If we give him a room for a minute, we might see that out of that grief, something else rose to the surface. because he's so unfairly singled out as though this is just an expression of his unwillingness to believe. And yet we can be so quick to forget how all of the other disciples responded when they were told by Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, the mother of James, that Jesus had risen from the dead. Luke says that when they told that to them, all of the disciples thought that this was an idle tale. And they did not believe them. So why Thomas gets singled out like he's the bad guy? John is not singling out Thomas because of his doubt. He's singling out Thomas because of his faith in the midst of his doubt. How so? Because he says, I have to see those scars. He says, unless I touch the wounds on his hands and place my hand in his sides, I will never believe. And that gets treated like an expression of his unwillingness to believe. Or somewhere in the midst of all of his grief, what he really longs for finally rose to the surface. He's simply saying, I have to encounter the resurrected Christ. I want to encounter my resurrected Lord. And unless he's resurrected, unless that body walked out of that grave, then what's the point in believing anything? Thomas is just expressing what Paul says elsewhere when he says that unless Christ rose from the dead bodily, then our faith is futile, we are without hope, and we are to be pitied above all people. So Thomas is expressing how he really heard what Jesus said. It's an expression of hope that Jesus really would overcome the world. This is not Thomas's doubt. This is Thomas's desire. He's expressing a faith that refuses to settle. He's unwilling to be satisfied with anything less than the resurrected Christ. He's saying, I have to touch those scars. It's those scars that would say that that body that was crucified and pierced and buried in the grave was the same body that was raised from the dead. I'm not interested in some spiritual, ethereal Jesus that just lives on after death somewhere out there. I'm not interested in some version of Jesus that's just a specter that's able to appear the way that he once did. I'm not interested in some resurrection metaphor that Jesus just lives on in some detached way from the pain of this world. I have to touch those scars. Because if that body still lies in the grave, then death still won. Because death still took his body from him. Death wasn't really defeated. Death wasn't really robbed. And those scars would tell me that everything that death took was taken back. I have to touch those scars to know that everything that was thrown at him still was not enough. I want a God with scars. Because I have to know that life overcame death. And finally, the world didn't win. Thomas gets it. That the only God worth believing in is a scarred God whose body will forever bear the marks of this world as an everlasting testament that death is defeated and he overcame the world. And somewhere in the midst of all of his grief and doubt, he found a faith that refused to settle for anything less than encountering the resurrected Christ. And evidently, that's what Jesus was waiting for, and now Thomas is ready to encounter him. Because 8 days later, he's with the disciples, with locked doors and closed windows, and boom, Jesus is right in front of him. Out of nothing, something, Jesus is there. And he walks straight to Thomas and he says, Thomas, you see my hands? Give me your hand. Touch them. You see my side? Put your hand in my side. Thomas, come close and believe. And man, I wish I could have seen Thomas's face. I wish I could have seen his face when the window black in his soul came crashing down and all of that light flooded in and his heart said, "Whoa." His mouth said, "My Lord and my God." And that is the only time in all four Gospels where someone says to Jesus, "My God." So, why would this story be about avoiding doubt when it's the very place that he encountered his God? And when he encountered him, it changed everything for Thomas. Because the resurrected Christ sent him out into a dark world, and this encounter propelled Thomas to walk that 5,000 miles into the darkness of the Kaligat, where no light had ever gone before. He saw all of that savage destruction, all the ruined lives that lined those brothel streets, and devastation so great, it is enough to make you doubt that good could come from such evil. But Thomas could enter in. Because his God had scars. He could tell the women in the brothel system whose bodies bore the scars of their abuse, "My God has scars too." And when the priests of Kali became so jealous of all of his converts and they came for him with spears, he could face it knowing that he had touched the scars that overcame the world. Behold the power of encountering the resurrected Christ. And I know what you're thinking. Maybe somewhere in the back of your mind, it's easy to think, well, yeah, it's easy for Thomas when he saw Jesus live and in the flesh. But Jesus has your number. He told Thomas, "You have seen and you have believed, but blessed are those who have not seen and believed." Jesus is saying, equally blessed, equally joyful, equally confident, equally strengthened, equally preserved, equally lifted up, equally happy, equally blessed are those who believe but have not seen. John writes for people who live in a dark and broken world that he knows is filled with grief. And he knows that that grief will produce doubts that convince us that the darkness won't lift, that the damage can't be undone, that things will never change, and life could never be made new. He writes for us, knowing that we will so often feel like the world won. And those scars tell you something different. They tell you that those are the exact moments where you will find him. It's through Thomas that you are given permission to have a faith that refuses to settle for anything less than an encounter with the resurrected Christ. And to encounter him is to be changed by him. To be changed in the way that you engage the world and all of its darkness and grief as one who knows that they belong, body and soul, to a scarred God who overcame the world. And he's the God who longs for you to say, "My Lord and my God." He's the God who wants your heart to say, "Whoa." For the glory of Christ and the life of the world, let's pray. Lord Jesus, we come to you on this beautiful Easter Resurrection Sunday. We ask that your light would shine into our hearts. We ask that your light would shine into the grief that we experience in this world. Those areas that we have long felt as though nothing will ever change. Things will always be the same, and the world wins. But you are the God that brings life from death, that shines light into darkness. You are the God that tears down the window black in our souls and allows your light to flood in and changes us by the light of your glory. We ask that you would give us faith that clings to you, but a faith that knows above all what we need is an encounter with you, to feel your presence with us, to feel you come close, and for us to know the power and the beauty, the strength and the joy of a God who carries the scars of this world in his body. We thank you for them, for they remind us that goodness has conquered evil. We ask all this in your precious name. Amen.